So, yeah, Paul, can pure will be formulated?
I would say no, because that would be a purpose. Pure will, unassuaged of purpose, and delivered from the lust of result, is the wine in Liber Al. And I like Castaneda's idea about this when he talks about impeccability. Impeccability is a pure, unadulterated response to a situation. To act impeccably means that I am responding as opposed to reacting to a situation. And that is the nature of pure will. The idea of true will is a direct contrast to that, in that true will, I'm sure, can be formulated. In other words, I can determine a meaning for my own life, and I can determine my own destiny. But that's not pure will. And true will is not addressed in Liber Al. That doesn't mean we can't incorporate it somehow into, Thelemic canon, shall we say. But in pure will, I'm responding impeccably to the environmental conditions of the moment. Whereas in true will, I'm acting deliberately and deliberatively. And that's an entirely different concept. And this is, I think, the most aggravating part of the confusion that Crowley sets up with that one little section that he writes in Magic and Theory and Practice. Because over and over and over again, you hear Thelemites talking about how their true will was interfered with, as if they think they know it. And it's every little thing they want. It's my true will to, rip you off for $5 because I can get away with it. It gets to the point of absurdity, because they're trying to use the authority of Liber Al to raise their true will to a point of importance.
So, okay. Paul, which quote from Magic in Theory and Practice do you refer to?
There's a section early on in Magic in Theory and Practice where Crowley talks about the true will. He even says if everybody's doing their true will, the Earth would be a wonderful place.
Hey, I've got the quote from Magic in Theory and Practice.
Okay.
He wrote that in Magic in Theory and Practice, he stated that true will is a course depending partly on the self and partly on the environment, which is natural and necessary for each. And then he goes on and on with true will, referring to it as far as how to fulfill it.
Yeah, and I may seek fulfillment of my true will, assuming that I know what my true will is. I may seek fulfillment of that through various activities that I may do. And I believe earlier on we spoke about that in the first half of this recording, where we spoke of this idea that various activities that I may do, it may be a contribution to my true will to write a book. Okay? But writing the book is not my true will. Okay, that may, in effect, serve my true will in some way. However, that all has nothing to do with pure will. Because pure will is described in Liber Al as being unassuaged of purpose and delivered without the lust of intent, where true will is all about intent. Okay, so this is why I like this idea of acting impeccably. Again, let's say I get caught up in a situation, one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't situations. The impeccable action would be somebody who spontaneously finds that third way out.
At the same time, we don't want to confuse the pure will with always winning, because there are times when we are supposed to lose. It's just a condition of our existence.
Yes.
Up and down.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree with you there. But so the real key there is simply acting spontaneously, whether we win or lose.
Yes, with joy. If you're not experiencing joy, in my opinion, you're losing sight of your pure will. Now, that doesn't mean you won't experience suffering. In my opinion, if you're in touch with the pure will, even during intense suffering, there is an awareness of a subtle joy accompanying that suffering.
Certainly, you always get the whole coin.
Sorry?
You never get half a coin. You always get the whole coin, heads and tails.
Yeah, right? But I bring it up because there's because joy is the real key, in my opinion, to knowing when we are on track. But then people confuse that and think, oh, I'm suffering. I'm supposed to just feel happy all the time. And no, that is not what is meant by all existence being pure joy. But the awareness of a subtle joy that's pervading all things.
Khalid Gibran wrote in the poem on joy and sorrow, he wrote about joy and sorrow being, you know, springing from the same source. And I think what he is referring to is passion. When you're,
yes,
you're so enthralled by those emotions.
That's an interesting point, because we could say that it's called passion, though joy is on one side and suffering is on the other. You know, and so that third way out that I kind of referred to then is to have that impassioned response, because passion, of course, is an impeccable response. You can't intend to be passionate. You know what I'm saying? It's a spontaneous response that comes to the heart, which leads us to a very important point. Can we separate will, especially pure will, from love? And I don't think you can. You know, notice in the Thelemic chant that do it thy will shall be the whole of the law is the first part. The second part says love is the law, love under will. If doing the will is the law and love is the law, they have to be part and participle of the same thing. So, and love and passion are spontaneous acts. We have no control over those things. We can't intend to love or not love somebody. It wells up in us. It comes out of us unassuaged to purpose. But we see it in other ways, too, you know. I may fall in love with my secretary, though. I'm married and she's married. I can't help that response. You know what I'm saying? I either have to suppress it or act on it, but I can't just make it go away. I can't say, well, you know, I shouldn't love her because, you know, that's really immoral and blah, 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 blah. So I'll just stop loving her. You don't do that.
In the movie Dangerous Liaisons, he keeps on saying, it's beyond my control.
Yeah. Because it's coming up without purpose. And therefore, it may be the source of our own doing ourselves in, so to speak.
But the thing is, the more we accept the spontaneous flow of life, the more we can also interact with it consciously. I say interact with it, not control it. And it more becomes like a river, and you can start finding the channels and paddling to different parts of the channels and paddling around the rocks, and you're going with the current. So you can decide that you find that your wife is more superior to your secretary intellectually, but still choose to love your secretary. Now, it doesn't mean I'm having sexual intercourse with her, but it could mean that I experience tremendous love and intimacy with her in other ways, in our day-to-day interactions or what have you, and I channel it in a different way, but I don't suppress it. I acknowledge it. I accept it. I enjoy it. I embrace it. And I work with it.
That would be acting impeccably. That would be a description of what Castaneda is talking about. Okay, So in responding impeccably, as opposed to reacting, the lesser man would react and say, okay, you know, I'm getting an erection. It's time to figure out how to do the secretary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As opposed to other people who, when they get married, they suddenly have no social life anymore. They don't even have friends of the opposite sex. Like, what's up with that?
Yeah, well, they react to their jealousies and their fears.
I even believe in telling the other person what the feelings. I mean, if things are getting pretty hot, I mean, I have in the past even told people, you know, how I actually felt. Some of them would admit it and tell it back to me, and life goes on. Other ones would get scared and then, clam up, but you still see that they love you. And it's just really sad for them. They can't just admit their feelings and then let it go and live life normally.
Well, in a certain sense, we see problems with ideas of jealousy and ownership of our lovers as a will that does have purpose. That purpose being to respond to fear and to seek to protect what you have. You objectify your lover. You want to own him or her. And so the jealousy comes up in order to protect that relationship.
Okay? Well, there's a light side and a dark side. The light side of jealous feelings is wanting to make something sacred, you know? The same feeling I would have to a sacred space where I do ritual. Nobody goes there. If they go there and start kissing there, I'm going to want to kick their asses. Just like if I see some oaf disrespecting my wife, I'm going to want to break his arms or kill him, you know. It doesn't mean I'm going to do that, but I acknowledge it, I let it go, and I, you know, make the best of the situation.
I think there's a playful form of jealousy, and then there's real jealousy. Playful jealousies are—they're not really jealousies. They're just contrivances, really, to make the other laugh.
Yeah.
Real jealousy though, is an emotional disturbance, and implies so much more. It implies immediately the objectification of your lover. It implies, in objectifying your lover becomes an object to be loved instead of, because there's an absence of an intimate encounter.
Well, your lover becomes no longer a person, but a piece of property.
Yes.
That you can manipulate and control and own. But then the real love starts to die when you do that, because you're freezing things up.
Well, you can't love an object. There's intimacy with an object. Intimacy can only happen with another person, or at least another being.
Cause of that is fear, and lack of awareness of our primal fear, and the inability to work with it consciously.
As I brought up in this first half, this guy is telling me that because I published something that he wrote in a form that he has changed since I published it, that because I insisted on keeping it in the original form, I was interfering with his true will. Okay? He immediately begins to seek to project, to protect the new form, and he empowers me with the ability to interfere with his will, which says he doesn't have the inertia of the universe behind him.
Huh.
This is the misuse of this, and I think this is the confusion generated in magic and theory and practice as an improper response to Liber Al's teaching.
I think it's also, Crowley also had to make his ideas accessible to a certain level of understanding, too. And I think there are many layers of interpretation, even of magic and theory and practice. And the critique we're leveling here is the first layer of exegesis, which is a necessary evil, especially for his time. Because remember, he was speaking to people, at least the intelligent people of his time, who are familiar with the works of Hegel, who spoke of the universal will and the individual will, who were familiar with Nietzsche's will to power, which are also familiar with the Calvinist sense of destiny. So Crowley had to work with all of these pre-established ideas and take them from the ground up. I think Crowley did come to a proper understanding of pure will, but he also had to communicate to an audience in a specific time and place, in addition to dealing with his own cultural prejudices.
You bring up two very good points there. On the one hand, you're exactly right in saying that Crowley had all that to deal with. But I would further add to that, I think Crowley is bringing up really kind of another teaching that has nothing to do with Al, because we're reaching an age, and this whole thelemic age that he sees coming, the eon of Horus, is an eon of individuality, where no longer the herd mind, as Nietzsche might say, is more important than the individual, but the individual is at least as important as the community, the society.
Leads to a whole other area of politics.
On the other hand, though, I'm not so sure that Crowley really ever came to an understanding of pure will, because he never wrote anything on that in his commentaries.
If you look at the Book of Lies, I think he touches on it a lot. When he refers to himself as the hollow tube of heaven from which the fire channels down. I can't see how that could be a metaphor for anything other than spontaneity.
Well, I agree with you there. And so you have a strong point in the Book of Lies. I was referring to his commentaries on Al.
Well, I'm thinking of just his written works as a whole, as a whole system. And I do agree with you that you can see a sense of progress and development in Crowley's own understanding in the development of his works. I mean, he was still trying to understand Liber Al himself as he was writing his works.
Very good.
He was teaching humanity, but also working out his own understanding. Sorry.
Yeah, very good. I just misspoke there. I think you're right.
I'm not so much disagreeing, but adding to what you're saying. That's all.
In the whole of his body of work, yes. I was too narrow in saying that he didn't understand that because he didn't write commentary on pure will in his commentaries to Al itself. Neither the new comment, the old comment, the Jurenza's comment, none of his commentaries on Al, does he address that line for pure will on a suage of purpose.
But you make a salient point, a salient critique, in that initially we get the idea that, all I got to do is see my career counselor and know what my aptitude is, and I can go out and do my true will and be a good old American Protestant boy and bring home the hay and the bacon and yee-haw, you know. I'm sorry. This shit seriously anymore. I mean, I used to, and when life doesn't follow with it, you go crazy, you know?
I know what you mean. I've had that too. I thought, well, if I just get this better job or, you know, get on this career path or something, then, you know, things will be so much better and I'll find happiness and all that stuff.
Yeah, I've been singing that song on and off, and it's an old tendency that comes up once in a while, and every once in a while that tower gets completely smashed.
That's another point. There's another point in that, Gabby, that you bring up in the search for happiness, because I think we do equate happiness with love, and love is not necessarily a happy state of being.
No.
A lot of people come to mysticism, magic, yoga and meditation because, when you look at the ads for all these yoga programs and everything, you see these pictures of these people with these beaming smiles on their faces. This guy just goes right for these people because they practice yoga,
No, I can tell you there are a couple people who do yoga and they're still pretty much the same jerks that they were before. They're just a little bit more, I don't know, mellow about it or subtle.
And then there are the smug yogis, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a vegetarian. Are you? You know, and those are the people that like to smell their farts, you know, and think their shit doesn't stink.
Well, guys, I was listening to the discussion, and a little thing dawned on me, a distinction that I didn't really have before. But you're talking about spontaneity as a form of pure will, but a spontaneity with the inertia of the universe behind it.
Well, spontaneity is the inertia of the universe. You can't be spontaneous, in my opinion, without being connected to the inertia of the universe. And this connects entirely with the whole system of Taoism.
But I would say, you know, Earth spins spontaneously on its axis. It revolves around the sun spontaneously in its orbit. The sun and the solar system orbit the other solar systems spontaneously. It's the natural drive of things. I think the most interesting thing that I've come to understand is the joke itself. What makes people laugh? What is laughter? Laughter is an uncontrolled muscle response. In every description of laughter that you can bring, I can also describe as part and parcel a description of the orgasm.
And our seriousness is also a spontaneous act. I mean, being spontaneous doesn't always mean being a jackass, like I do sometimes, and PJ does a fair amount. So
do you guys remember when I forwarded the paper by Gerard DeCampo?
Oh, yeah, he's a big OTO guy, isn't he?
He was.
Remember? Oh, yeah. He was. Okay, I'm not up on that stuff. So what? I didn't read the paper. I'm busy as hell. It's hard for me to keep up on things. Do you want to brief us on it?
Yeah, it was a pretty short paper, but basically what he said was in all the petty arguments about true will, you know, try to find ways to get out of doing your will. So that reminded me of the verse in Liber Al, money fear not, nor laughter of the folk folly, which, you know, would really be distractions from being able to fulfill your will, however you want to interpret it, whether that's pure will or true will or the bud will, the will to live,
yeah,
and so on.
Well, certainly when we bring fear into things, we screw everything up. Fear's the mind killer, right? And pure will has to be, you know, an action of consciousness. And consciousness itself, especially as Sartre says, is really a nothingness. It needs objects to fill it. You know, it in itself cannot necessarily be evaluated, except that we have it.
Which explains the relevance of the yogic practice that Crowley suggested.
Well, yeah, because when you empty your mind of thoughts and objects, you experience pure consciousness. And if you can actually hold that experience for a length of time, say as the Zelador practices sitting in his or her asana for an hour, you have to get to a point where there's nothing in the mind. You know, for myself, I used a mantra to get through that hour because it cleared my mind. Without the mantra and the pranayama that supported that mantra, I found myself incredibly disturbed by my mind. It wanted to think of things, and I wanted to jump up and respond to the things I was thinking of. So it was a very difficult kind of thing. But when you can get to a state of pure consciousness, there's no objectification in that. There's no intent. You know, the bud will, as you say, Cammy, this is something that Grant writes a lot on. But that bud will has much more to do with true will than with pure will. Okay? And and we have to be careful there, because Budwill and True Will can be, Budwill rather, I should say, can be something that can serve my True Will, but it in itself is not my True Will. Okay? It may be my Budwill to launch a website, and so I'm going to take that Budwill and find a way to manifest that. But launching that website may serve my True Will in that I've, you know, perhaps part and parcel of my True Will is that it gets a message out, or it allows a place for me to speak and bring out that which is within me, which is more my True Will, but not the website. So as if some of these hackers in the past have tried to hack down my website, they weren't interfering with my True Will, but they were attacking the object of my Budwill.
Right.
Yeah, I see the Budwill is like a seed.
Yeah.
All the petty arguments online and Yahoo groups and even people hacking your website, those are the attempts towards the so-called laughter of the folk folly.
Yes.
I like that. That's a really cool observation. I never thought of that.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I mean, they've certainly thrown enough jokes around at my expense. You can see some of the pictures they made up of me on the website.
Yeah, right? There were rebellion words. They even made up like a pasta named after you, right?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Rebelli ravioli or something like that.
Yeah. You know, I'm in a bad
spot. I didn't know you were that tasty.
Well, you know, at least somebody had some repressed sexual desires towards me. We shall leave that bigot in Holland to his own devices there.
But I mean, the laughter of the folk folly, as you express it or talk about, Cammy, isn't that a part of it in a way?
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with, I guess, sort of sharing with your peers and, you know, seeing what they have to say about it. But you don't need to ask approval before doing something, you know, like, hey, Mom, Dad, can I go and do this? It sounds so immature.
But, I mean, just having, going through a process like that, being ridiculed, being tested, in a way, having your...
Oh, that's I think so, yes. I mean, that's part of it.
Well, paradox is part of the universe, and one paradox is every man and every woman is a star. Even the people that we are calling... who are performing the laughter of the folly, so to speak, they are also stars. And the ordeal of being in a universe is conflict of interests.
Well, now this is all kind of interesting to me, because let's just say for a second that, you know, that my True Will was to get out the message, these ideas that I have. And so I get these ideas out, and I remember back in those days, pre-9/11, I really felt that I had something important to say to Thelemites, and I was initially quite surprised by their angered rejection of my ideas. Subsequent to that, after I got past, shall we say, the hurt, because I expected that these ideas would be embraced, people would say, oh, you know, that's kind of interesting. I never thought about it that way. That was what I was hoping to formulate. And I thought that was my intent. When we got past 9/11 and, you know, all the ridicule and the attacks and the nasty things that they did, I actually ended up with a much bigger vision. I came to realize that my intent was to get my message out to a larger audience than, you know, the couple of anthills that exist in Lima. I actually wanted to reach a larger audience, and I've redirected my whole idea of getting this message out in that sense. This is how the Gnostic Church and why I got interested in doing commentaries on the Gnostic Gospels that I did and everything. I'm trying to reach a larger audience to say we can embrace as a society these ideas without society having to necessarily convert to Thelema. Okay, because my intent has never been conversion.
So actually, the laughter of the folk foley actually added to it.
It served me. They clustered about and exalted me.
That's the paradox, is that, every man and every woman is a star. So even those that in some way may seem off their course and are trying to interfere with your will, they're also in another way serving it. But this is the nature of the paradox. And to really accept that, we have to accept that part of existing in the world means interacting with paradox.
Well, yeah, I mean, once I got past the initial hurt, because my initial expectations were quite naive, and I found ultimately quite all too limited. I came to realize that once I could think clearly again, after the death threat stopped, after we came off the public e-groups and they stopped attacking, and I didn't have to spend hours a day deleting fake messages and all this kind of crap. Once I found relief from all of that, I was able to sit back again and contemplate, and I was like, wow, these guys, in a certain sense, did me a marvelous service. I've refocused my efforts and came to a better knowledge of what my real intent was and what I was doing. And through all of that, I've since come to meet far more interesting and profound people, in more educated quarters of society, as opposed to the pseudo scholars of, the Caliphate and other lesser organizations. In Thelema, I came to be around some people that were really scholars, and they found my ideas interesting, and I also realized I've always known I've never been on an act of conversion, although I've been accused of it. It wasn't about converting. They found that my ideas harmonized well with their ideas, and both of us found an expansion of knowledge with neither being converted to the other, shall we say, system.
Well, yeah, and I recall also the injunction in Chapter 3 of the Book of the Law. If that is our book by which we accept, argue not, convert not, talk not over much.
Right, and I've always admired that because even long before I ever became a Thelemite, because you can't convince somebody to be something that they're not.
But them that seek to attack thee, to entrap thee, to overthrow thee, them destroy without pity or quarter.
Attack them without, I'm not quoting Al, but I mean basically it's saying attack them without pity.
I'm paraphrasing because I know some of my words are slightly off.
Yeah.
But all of those listening, feel free to look up those words in Chapter 3. You see them exactly as they are. I don't have my copy in front of me now.
And I got the one guy that attacked my website. I got it to the point that he's not even allowed on the web. His website came down, and he couldn't do anything about it. Now, the other guy that's sitting in Holland right now can't find work that easily because I'm keeping up all his nasty stuff on my website. And people have come at me and said, why do you keep all that nasty stuff up there? I'm like, you don't know what it's like getting crank phone calls every day, death threats, this and that. These become the things that I need to do to keep them, because if I sit down there and play weak man and I stick my head in the sand, they're just going to shove rocks up my ass.
Not only that, revenge is sweet. I don't care what anybody says.
It is very sweet.
Revenge isn't a good thing in itself, but there's a certain level of it that is sweet.
Bahur Kuwait is a god of vengeance. Remember that.
At the same time, don't seek revenge at the expense of your will. If you're seeking after revenge to prove something again, and there's no joy in it, then you're off your course. But if it's coming spontaneously and naturally, and it's working, this is also the way the universe moves. And as much as we don't like revenge, and these darker aspects of our nature, they're still going to be there. They always have been there. And they will always continue to be there, no matter what our species mutates into. Indeed, it's a part of nature.
Indeed, I acted with that positive result. I just simply kept notes of what these guys were doing. I put some of those notes up on the web. And years later, it's come back to haunt them.
Yeah, everybody fulfills their thing in their own way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for all the people around the country that Ray Eels and Joshua Zintel and all those guys over who are, you know, they got on the phone and started talking, oh, Ravelli's a real weirdo, be careful, you know, and they sent me into a whole bunch of traps. You know, I tell you, every single year, somebody contacts me out of their lineage saying, you know, you were right, I read your stuff. You know, can we join your lineage? Because we're done with these guys. You know, that wasn't
us. I was, remember when I was a probationer in this lineage, I was doing some Gnostic masses with a couple guys from the Caliphate OTO. And when they heard your name, they tried to convince me of a lot of bad things about you, but none of them would give specific examples. And when people don't give you specific examples or verifiable information, you immediately have to be suspicious. And I'm like, well, things are going pretty good so far. I'm going to trust my own intuition, my own instincts, my own common sense. And so be it. And the one guy was actually reasonable enough that after I came back from visiting you, he asked me how you were, and I said, well, it was an enjoyable visit. He actually apologized to me for getting all political.
Yeah, that's all that is.
So, yeah, and that takes a lot of balls. I actually admired him for that. I'm not going to say any names here, of course.
But yeah, but certainly somebody capable of looking at real evidence instead of innuendo and rumor is at least a more conscious human being than those that are completely entrapped by innuendo and rumor. I mean, I've lived a life of being surrounded by innuendo. By the time I graduated high school, you know, kids were convinced I was sticking heroin needles in my eyes and all this other kind of stuff. Because this is what people do. You know, and I've always said to people, you know something, if I did 1/100th of the things people have said I've done, I'd either be dead or in jail. So think about it.
Hmm.
You know?
So that would be things actually adding to your pure will then.
Well, yes, it's always served because in the end, my name got around. Some people decided to say, you know something, they've said so much stuff about this guy, I'm going to talk to him for a second. And all of a sudden, I'm making new friends of people that might have ignored me and passed me by before.
Well, I first heard of Crowley was in an article about him first stating the negative rumors about Crowley. And actually, I thought, wow, what a crazy fucked up guy. And then I remember reading the quote from the Book of the Law, and something and it hooked me. I couldn't drop it. And like, why am I so attracted to this quote from this guy that was supposedly so evil? And then that led me to actually look for his work online. And I'm reading his work, and I'm like, something doesn't add up here, you know, with what I'm hearing about him. Feels like something's missing. How could somebody write such profound stuff and be, you know, this bad as people make him out to be? I'm sure he was no angel, but the negative attention led me to actually look into it further because it also exposed some of his good ideas to me.
I don't want to compare myself to Crowley, but we do have one thing in common, and that is we both stand out in the crowd. We're not everybody else. Or shall I say, we're not normal, right? The guy that stands out in the crowd is the guy who's conscious, who's at least a little bit awake and is doing something of his own effort, of his own merit, and he's practicing his own personal sense of his own nobility. He's exposing his own nobility. And of course,
there are a lot of conscious people, too, who are clever and disguise themselves so they don't get killed by the mob while they're building their original conscious ideas.
Certainly, Certainly, but those are the shut-ups.
That's not true. Libero says, lurk, withdraw, then upon. It's also a method of carrying out the law.
But then eventually you've got to bring yourself out of the crowd. You're going to stand up with your knife and you're going to start throwing. Okay?
Upon them. That's the last part.
They're eventually going to come upon them. There are those that are very intelligent but will never, ever stand out, will never let you know. And indeed, when the crowd starts yelling, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him, they're going to yell it too. They're going to actually vote against their own interests.
Well, those aren't the people that I was talking about, but I do see what you're referring
to. The guys that stand up and say, I've got something to say, and no one said it quite like this before, or this is something no one else has said before, or it's certainly contradictory to the accepted facts that are incorporated into social norms.
But to be as loud, I think Crowley's loudness isn't entirely connected to his spiritual integrity. It's also connected to he could afford to be loud. He had enough money and power to protect himself at his time.
In the end, he tried
the right people off and to fuck up people if he had to.
Crowley used to think that bad publicity was still good publicity until near the end of his life when he was out of money. And he tried to sue for slander, and he no longer could. Because a lie told often enough often becomes the truth. Most people in the United States today, because of the yellow press, are convinced that Crowley was murdering babies on altars on Friday nights, and all this other kind of stuff. And they've never read Crowley. They're just going with, slanderous innuendos and rumors that have been passed around by the yellow press. And they're buying. It's been told for so long. Crowley was very popular in this country at one point because, the Art Deco era came in, the Rosetta Stone was translated, Crowley was the one who was well known for Egyptian study, and everybody flocked towards him. Then the yellow press came into vogue, and they started hammering at both him and Blavatsky, for that matter, and people stopped paying attention to that. They clung to the Christian guys because they're the good guys, right? Okay, and now Crowley's got this reputation that, it almost takes courage to check his book out of the library.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a little thought here because we're talking about dealing with ignorant people or ignorance, actually. And I read this quote from the Book of Toth the other day, and I thought it was really interesting, and I would like to hear what you have to say on that. And it says here in the beginning that every star possesses boundless wealth, and the only proper way to deal with the ignorant is to bring them to the knowledge of their starry heritage. To do this, it is necessary to behave as must be done in order to get on good terms with animals and children, to treat them with absolute respect, even in a certain sense with worship. So did you get me on that one?
He's talking about the art of persuasion there. I can't help but always seeing some of the Christian upbringing in Crowley because we're kind of back to the act of conversion. Am I really interested in converting someone? Yeah, I can walk up to that Christian and just profoundly submit these ideas as I condescend to talk down to this Christian. And eventually, maybe with a long stream of effort, I might be able to break through the cognitive dissonance. And then I might get that person to see these great ideas. And maybe I've elevated that person, or at least facilitated that person's elevation. But in the end, was it worth the effort?
I beg to differ. Not on what you're arguing against, but in how you're interpreting Crowley's instruction there. Okay. I see that as just a way of dealing with people that you can't avoid or that you are in must-have relationships with. It's really a coping technique. I mean, you can profoundly influence people, not to convert to Thelema, not to see themselves as a star, but at least just to manage them by treating them with profound respect. And I just saw it as a way of managing those people that you're stuck living with, where you have to deal with at work, that you can't afford to just run away from or tell to go to hell. And he gives another technique, too. He tells you in his confessions that he's destroyed many of his enemies by simply loving them, by projecting all of his love toward them, people who are stealing money from him or stabbing him behind his back. And he described it as a method of magical attack, not as a Christist or Christian turning of the other cheek, but as a way of building a magical link with that person in which all of their malice and hatred eventually affects them. And he described several people committing suicide or having terrible misfortunes after him projecting his love on them while they're trying to sabotage him. It's too bad I can't remember the page number of it. If anybody ever else encounters that, or any other listeners of this podcast, they want to comment or even give the page number, that would be awesome, because it's a big book to leaf through.
I have to go with Ryan on this one as far as killing them with kindness.
Yeah, that's an excellent. I never thought of that. Yes.
That all makes perfect sense. I mean, I only thought about an isolated incident, and I could have thought, in a more wider scope there.
Yeah, I've seen bad fortune happen to people who were hurting me when I projected intense love onto them in the past, and I didn't lose any sleep over their bad.
But really, I think that if you're straight, if you have integrity in your dealings with things or with people in your life, I mean, and that person, you know, later on they come to remember you, they'll remember you because it was, you know, maybe it was profound, or they remember you fondly or in some important way. That you
not only that, if somebody's really out of their place and trying to screw you, in my opinion, the chances are, it's unconscious, they're going to feel guilty about it or feel like sabotage themselves in some way. If you really are being the leader in the situation, you're not giving your power away to the other person. And either they'll grow up or their own behavior will destroy them in the end. I remember one guy who had swindled me out of money many years ago. And I really, had fantasies of tracking him down and getting my money back through force, which is impossible because he's a junkie. And then I thought to myself, Ryan, here's the interesting part. You don't have to do anything, and he's going to get beaten up. And guess what? I met him a year later. He was trying to rob a friend of mine in the same building, and he was missing all of his front teeth.
Oh,
full of scars. And I didn't have to raise a physical finger. It was his own, basically his own behavior, his own motion, his ill motion backfiring on him.
He's already in a violent universe.
Yeah, and of course, wanting to seek, go out of your way to chase somebody down is more an act of vanity anyways, because they say the best revenge is success.
Yeah. That's exactly true.
If I chased down $80 that were stolen, when I could work at becoming a millionaire.
Exactly true. Okay, we're running in. We got about 2 minutes left here.
Yeah, I got to get going soon too. So how are we going to wrap this up, folks?
Yeah. Okay. I guess I could we'll end this discussion now. But I kind of wanted a good punchline.
Thanks to these podcasts, being a nerd is sexy.
Yeah.